Hi, I'm Anthony Brabazon.
And I'm Paul Caffrey.
And this is the God's Talk programme for the next half hour on 90.3 Near FM, where we'll be grappling with the big questions of life from a biblical perspective.
We'd love to hear from our listeners. You can email us on nearfmgodtalk@gmail.com, or you can get us on Twitter at nearfmgodtalk.
And also on the web, you can get the website, which is godtalkradioblog.wordpress.com. And so, Paul, this week we're doing a little bit different. We have managed to go back to the vault.
Okay, and, so what have we got from the vault?
From our secret believer, we have a very special extract from an author called C.S. Lewis.
Oh, okay. Interesting. So this is a passage from The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, I believe.
Yeah, it's a children's book. Mm-hmm. But when we say that, it's a children's book with a lot of meaning behind it.
Mm. Yeah, C.S. Lewis, an interesting writer, born in Belfast, so a man who came regularly back and forth to Ireland on holidays, though he lived most of his time, most of his life in Oxford and Cambridge as a professor. And he had a conversion to Christianity. He had rejected his early faith. He was raised Church of Ireland in Belfast, and he rejected all that. He was a soldier in the First World War and all that that implied in terms of the effect it had on him. And then subsequently he began rethinking. He was a very close friend of J.R.R. Tolkien.
He wrote The Lord of the Rings.
Wrote The Lord of the Rings. They were friends. And Tolkien influenced him also in his conversion to Christianity. And so he's written a lot of things. He has written stuff in his own field, which is medieval English literature. He has written some science fiction, a famous trilogy of science fiction. And then during the Second World War, he did a series of radio broadcasts that started as talks to the troops originally. And they were finally, they're supposed to be Christian apologetics, so he's really making the case for Christianity. Interesting that he doesn't start from the scriptures. He doesn't take for granted that anybody knows anything about the Bible, but he builds up his case based really on the idea of morality, that everybody has a sense of right and wrong and where that comes from and so on. And so those talks were eventually written up as Mere Christianity.
Oh, that's a well-known book.
Book, and we may look at that another time. But then from 1950 through to 1956, he published six children's novels, which are usually called the Narnia series. They're set in an imaginary land called Narnia, which most of his most critics believe was based on the countryside he knew in County Down. Mm-hmm. A lot of the descriptions are very reminiscent of parts of the north, Northern Ireland, where he went back and forth on holidays year after year and where he had grown up as a boy. So the first of them to be published was The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, published in 1950, and that was followed by Prince Caspian, and then The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, The Silver Chair, The Horse and His Boy, The Magician's Nephew, and the last in the series is The Last Battle.
That's published a favourite of mine.
Yeah, 1956. Yeah. So they're not strictly, some people think, are these an allegory? You know, like, say, for example, Pilgrim's Progress is an allegory, and that you have Christian and you have Vanity Fair and so on, and everything in the book stands for something. In the Narnia Chronicles is not quite as straightforward as that, but you have, for example, the figure of Aslan the lion, who obviously is a Christ figure, and you have themes of redemption, themes of sin, themes of all of those kind of things.
Well, the piece we have today is particularly powerful, and I think we'll hand it
okay.
over now to,
Let's
our, secret
hand over to our secret believer.
90.3 Near FM God Talk. This is The Vault.
Peter, Susan, Edmund and Lucy have found their way into Narnia. The king of Narnia is Aslan. But there's also a wicked witch. And sadly, Edmund betrayed the other children to the wicked witch, who tried to kill Edmund eventually. Aslan rescued him. And we start from there. A few minutes later, the witch herself walked out onto the top of the hill and came straight across and stood before Aslan. The three children who had not seen her before felt shudders running down their backs at the sight of her face, and there were low growls among all the animals present. Though it was bright sunshine, everyone felt suddenly cold. The only two people present who seemed to be quite at their ease were Aslan and the witch herself. It was the oddest thing to see those two faces, the golden face and the dead white face so close together. Not that the witch looked Aslan exactly in his eyes. "You have a traitor there, Aslan," said the witch. Of course, everyone present knew that she meant Edmund. "Well," said Aslan, "his offence was not against you." "Have you forgotten the deep magic?" asked the witch. "Let us say I have forgotten it," answered Aslan gravely. "Tell us of this deep magic." "Tell you?" said the witch, her voice growing suddenly shriller. "Tell you what is written on that very table of stone which stands beside us? Tell you what is written in letters deep as a spear is long on the firestones on the secret hill? Tell you what is engraved on the sceptre of the emperor beyond the sea? You at least know the magic which the emperor put into Narnia at the very beginning. You know that every traitor belongs to me as my lawful prey, and that for every treachery I have a right to a kill. And so, that human creature is mine. Mine. His life is forfeit to me. His blood is my property." "Come and take it then," said the bull with the man's head, in a great bellowing voice. "Fool," said the witch with a savage smile that was almost a snarl, "do you really think your master can rob me of my rights by mere force? He knows the deep magic better than that. He knows that unless I have blood, as the law says, all Narnia will be overturned and perish in fire and water." "It is very true," said Aslan. "I do not deny it."
"Oh, Aslan," whispered Susan in the lion's ear, "can't we, I mean, you won't, will you? Can't we do something about the deep magic? Isn't there something you can work against it?"
"Work against the emperor's magic?" said Aslan, turning to her with something like a frown on his face. And nobody ever made that suggestion to him again. Edmund was on the other side of Aslan, looking all the time at Aslan's face. He felt a choking feeling and wondered if he ought to say something. But a moment later he felt that he was not expected to do anything except to wait and do what he was told. "Fall back, all of you," said Aslan, "and I will talk to the witch alone." They all obeyed. It was a terrible time, this, waiting and wondering while the lion and the witch talked earnestly together in low voices. Lucy said, "Oh, Edmund," and began to cry. Peter stood with his back to the others, looking out at the distant sea. The beavers stood holding each other's paws with their heads bowed. The centaurs stamped uneasily with their hoofs. But everyone became perfectly still in the end, so that you noticed even small sounds like a bumblebee flying past, or the birds in the forest down below them, or the wind rustling the leaves. And still the talk between Aslan and the White Witch went on. At last they heard Aslan's voice. "You can all come back," he said. "I have settled the matter. She has renounced the claim on your brother's blood." And all over the hill there was a noise as if everyone had been holding their breath and now had begun breathing again, and then a murmur of talk. The witch was just turning away with a look of fierce joy on her face when she stopped and said, "But how do I know this promise will be kept?" "Rrrr!" roared Aslan, half rising from his throne, and his great mouth opened wider and wider, and the roar grew louder and louder, and the witch, after staring for a moment with her lips wide apart, picked up her skirts and fairly ran for her life. As soon as the witch had gone, Aslan said, "We must move from this place at once. It will be wanted for other purposes. We shall encamp tonight at the fords of Beruna."
"Wouldn't it be better to camp on the far side for fear she might try a night attack or anything?" said Peter.
Aslan, who seemed to have been thinking about something else,
roused himself with a shake of his magnificent mane and said, "Eh? What's that?" Peter said it all over again. "No," said Aslan in a dull voice, as if it didn't matter. "No, she will not make an attack tonight." And then he sighed deeply. But presently, he added, "All the same, it was well thought of. That is how a soldier ought to think. But it doesn't really matter." So they proceeded to pitch their camp. Aslan's mood affected everyone that evening. Peter was feeling uncomfortable, too, at the idea of fighting the battle on his own. The news that Aslan might not be there had come as a great shock to him. Supper that evening was a quiet meal. Everyone felt how different it had been last night, or even that morning. It was as if the good times, having just begun, were already drawing to their end. This feeling affected Susan so much that she couldn't get to sleep when she went to bed. And after she had lain counting sheep and turning over and over, she heard Lucy give a long sigh and turn over just beside her in the darkness. "Can't you get to sleep either?" said Susan. "No," said Lucy. "I thought you were asleep." "I say, Susan." "What?" "I've had a most horrible feeling, as if something were hanging over us." "Have you? Because as a matter of fact, so have I." "Something about Aslan," said Lucy. "Either some dreadful thing is going to happen to him, or else something dreadful that he's going to do." "There's been something wrong with him all afternoon," said Susan. "Lucy, what was that he said about not being with us at the battle? You don't think he could be stealing away and leaving us tonight, do you?" "Where is he now?" said Lucy. "Is he here in the pavilion?" "I don't think so." "Susan, let's go outside and have a look round. We might see him." "All right, let's," said Susan. "We might just as well be doing that as lying awake here." Very quietly, the two girls groped their way among the other sleepers and crept out of the tent. The moonlight was bright and everything was quite still, except for the noise of the river chattering over the stones. Then Susan suddenly caught Lucy's arm and said, "Look!" On the far side of the camping ground, just where the trees began, they saw the lion walking slowly away from them into the wood. Without a word, they both followed him. He led them up the steep slope, out of the river valley, and then slightly to the right, apparently by the very same route which they had used that afternoon in coming from the hill of the stone table. On and on he led them. He looked somehow different from the Aslan they knew. His tail and his head hung low, and he walked slowly, as if he were very, very tired. Then, when they were crossing a wide open place where there were no shadows for them to hide in, he stopped and looked round. It was no good trying to run away, so they came toward him. When they were closer, he said, "Oh, children, children, why are you following me?" "We couldn't sleep," said Lucy. And then felt sure that she need say no more, and that Aslan knew all that they had been thinking. "Please may we come with you wherever you're going?" asked Susan. "Well," said Aslan, "I should be glad of company tonight." "Yes, you may come, if you will promise to stop when I tell you, and after that leave me to go on alone." "Oh, thank you, thank you, and we will," said the two girls. And so the girls did what they would never have dared to do without his permission, but what they had longed to do ever since they first saw him, buried their cold hands in the beautiful sea of fur and stroked it, and so doing walked with them. And presently they saw that they were going with him up the slope of the hill on which the stone table stood. Aslan stopped and said, "Oh, children, children, here you must stop, and whatever happens, do not let yourselves be seen. Farewell." And both the girls cried bitterly, though they hardly knew why. They clung to the lion and kissed his mane and his nose and his paws and his great sad eyes. Then he turned from them and walked out onto the top of the hill. And Lucy and Susan, crouching in the bushes, looked after him. And this is what they saw. A great crowd of people were standing all round the stone table, and though the moon was shining, Many of them carried torches, which burned with evil-looking red flames and black smoke. But such people! Ogres with monstrous teeth, and wolves, and bull-headed men, spirits of evil trees and poisonous plants, and other creatures whom I won't describe, because if I did, the grown-ups would probably not let you read this book. Cruels and hags and incubuses, wraiths, horrors, sprites, wooses and ettins. In fact, here were all those who were on the witch's side and whom the wolf had summoned at her command. And right in the middle, standing by the table, was the witch herself. The fool has come, she cried. Bind him fast. Lucy and Susan held their breaths, waiting for Aslan's roar and his spring upon his enemies. But it never came. Four hags, grinning and leering, had approached him. Bind him, I say, repeated the white witch. The hags made a dart at him and shrieked with triumph when they found that he made no resistance at all. Then others, evil dwarfs and apes, rushed in to help them, and between them they rolled the huge lion over on his back and tied all his four paws together, shouting and cheering as if they had done something brave. Though, had the lion chosen, one of those paws could have been the death of them all. But he made no noise, even when his enemies, straining and tugging, pulled the cords so tight that they cut into his flesh. Then they began to drag him toward the stone table. Stop, said the witch. Let him first be shaved. Another roar of mean laughter went up from her followers as an ogre with a pair of shears came forward and squatted down by Aslan's head. Snip, snip, snip went the shears, and masses of curling gold began to fall to the ground. The children watching from their hiding place could see the face of Aslan looking all small and different without its mane. Oh, how can they, said Lucy, tears streaming down her cheeks. The brutes, the brutes! For now that the first shock was over, the shorn face of Aslan looked to her braver and more beautiful and more patient than ever. Muzzle him, said the witch. Everyone was at him now. Those who had been afraid to come near him, even after he was bound, began to find their courage. And for a few minutes the two girls could not even see him, so thickly was he surrounded by the whole crowd of creatures kicking him, hitting him, spitting on him, jeering at him. At last the rabble had had enough of this. They began to drag the bound and muzzled lion to the stone table, some pulling, some pushing. The cowards, sobbed Susan. And they're still afraid of him, even now. When once Aslan had been tied on the flat stone, a hush fell on the crowd. The witch bared her arms as she had bared them the previous night when it had been Edmund instead of Aslan. The witch then began to whet her knife. It looked to the children, when the gleam of the torchlight fell on it, as if the knife were made of stone, not of steel. And it was of a strange and evil shape. At last she drew near. She stood by Aslan's head. Her face was working and twitching with passion. But his looked up at the sky, still quiet, neither angry nor afraid, but a little sad. Then, just before she gave the blow, she stooped down and said in a quivering voice, "And now, who has won? Fool, did you think that by all this you would save the human traitor? Now I will kill you instead of him, as our pact was, and so the deep magic will be appeased. And when you are dead, what will prevent me from killing him as well? And who will take him out of my hand then? Understand this, you've given me Narnia forever. You have lost your own life, and you have not saved his. In that knowledge, despair and die." The children did not see the actual moment of the killing. They couldn't bear to look and had covered their eyes.
Well, I tell you, that was a gripping story, a wonderful piece, you know, and it just brings you right in the dilemma faced about the death for Edmund that he deserved, and yet what happened in its place.
Yeah, it's interesting. That chapter that we heard was actually called The Triumph of the Witch. And it ends at that dramatic moment when it says the children didn't see the actual moment of the killing. In other words, when the White Witch was about to slay Aslan.
Right.
So it's a kind of a cliffhanger. We're left wondering what happens next. And the following chapter, of course, is Deeper Magic from the Dawn of Time.
Right. What's that about?
Deeper Magic from the Dawn of Time means that Aslan, in fact, is resuscitated. Aslan comes back to life. And you see, in the deep magic from the Dawn of Time, the deep magic, which our reader read for us there, was that because the traitor owed a life. In other words, the traitor was doomed to die.
Yep.
But that clearly what happens there is Aslan takes the place of the traitor and dies in place of the traitor. So when Aslan is resuscitated, comes back to life, he explains to the children don't understand. They say, they think maybe he's a ghost. And Susan says, you're not a ghost. And Aslan says, do I look it? She says, no, you're real. And she says, well, what's happened? How come you're back to life? I mean, we saw the witch about to kill you and all of that. And Aslan says, it means that though the witch knew the deep magic, that's what we heard about there. There is a deeper magic still, which she didn't know.
Yeah.
Her knowledge goes back only to the dawn of time. But if she could have looked a little further back into the stillness and the darkness before time dawned, she would have read there's a different incantation. She would have known that when a willing victim who had committed no treachery was killed in a traitor's stead, the table would crack and death itself would start working backwards.
Isn't that some statement? Death would start working backwards.
Death would start working backwards. Yeah. And so Aslan comes back to life. And then the next, what happens then, there's a chapter then after that called What Happened About the Statues. He goes into the witch's castle and there you have all these petrified Narnians.
That's right, because they had these animals who were like creature people. They'd been frozen by the curse.
They'd all been frozen, exactly.
And turned to stone.
So they'd all been turned to stone. And one of the people there was Mr. Tumnus, the fawn, that the children meet at the very beginning of the story. And so Aslan breathes on each of these one by one, breathes on them, and gradually they turn back from stone to life. So they come back to life.
It's amazing. It's like Jesus. The risen Jesus breathed on his disciples.
He said,
receive the Holy Spirit. And it was like they became alive.
And that they came back to life. So really it's about what we talked about a few weeks ago. We said, Jesus said, behold, I make all things new. And that in some ways that's what Aslan is doing. So he's reversing the curse where it was always winter but never Christmas. And so that everything changes and all these people are brought back to life. The petrified Narnians are restored to life. The children then are crowned as kings and queens in Narnia.
Well, I once met a number of years ago. I met a chap called Douglas Gresham, who happens to be C.S. Lewis's stepson and features in the film called Shadowlands about C.S. Lewis. And I remember him talking at the time. He was having a great battle with Hollywood because they wanted to make the new versions of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe and these films. But the script they kept sending to him, he had to keep rejecting them because they were airbrushing out the real meaning of the
Christian message,
the Christian theme here. And eventually the films they did make probably about 8 or 10 years ago were very good because they kept in the main theme in there. But in these books, The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe and the other Narnia Chronicles, the absolute meaning is so fantastic because it's showing the gospel. And that's what excites me about it. And that's why there's something special when you read these books. They really, they evoke something deep inside of you. And Aslan, of course, so lovable, you know, but he's that picture of Jesus. And it's just so amazing how he took the place of the rebel, Edmund, and all.
That's right, with the innocent one. It's fascinating because, of course, Lewis wasn't a trained theologian. He wasn't a scripture scholar. Mm-hmm. He was, literature was his field. And so he loved stories. And he based a lot of his stories on medieval, the whole world of medieval poetry and medieval fiction and all those stories, the famous mystery plays of medieval times and so on, which were meant to just give the ordinary people an idea of the great themes, the great Christian themes, such as the, you know, the four steps as creation, fall, redemption and consummation. So if you can imagine, it's like two downward steps, creation, step downwards at the fall, and then redemption, the work of Christ in dying for our sins, mm-hmm. and then consummation, which is the restoration of all things when Jesus comes back again.
Yeah.
When he restores everything to what it should have been. So it's back to what it was at the beginning.
Well, yes.
So Lewis was thinking all the times in terms of stories, and because a bit like his friend, his pal Tolkien, they were big into mythology and ancient stories and myths. And the whole idea of these myths was that they somehow portrayed aspects of truth. It's interesting because the lion, there's just one reference to Jesus in the New Testament as the lion.
Lion of the tribe.
Do you know where that is?
In Revelation.
It's in Revelation chapter 5 and verse 5. It says, "The lion of the tribe of Judah has conquered."
Yeah.
So the lion of the tribe of Judah, and of course it refers back to a prophecy of Israel back in the book of Genesis, where he talks about Judah as a lion cub.
Yeah.
And so Jesus is the lion of the tribe of Judah, and Aslan is a pale image, or a sort of a picture of it. And I think a few weeks ago I referred to something from the Mere Christianity, where Lewis says in a different tone, he's not telling a story here, he's talking in terms of apologetics. He says, enemied occupied territory is what this world is, and the real king has landed in disguise. And you see, that's at the beginning of the Narnia Chronicles. They say Aslan is on the move. They say Aslan has landed already. So we believe that the lion has landed, that he really has conquered, and that he is working towards the story of the statues, the restoration of all things.
Well, you're listening to Near FM 90.3. This is the God Talk program, and we're here every week at 5 o'clock. And so, listen, thank you all very much for listening in.
Thank you, listeners. I would encourage anyone who hasn't already read The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, pick up a copy and read it.
Okay.
It's a great story.
God bless you.
Good evening,
listeners. See you next week. Bye-bye.